Good afternoon. From Aspen Public Radio, I'm Allison Bechtesh. This is Airtime, extended conversations with interesting people. This week, Christine Potter uses black and white photography to question masculinity and mythology in the American West.
I'm always looking for ways to complicate the story we've told ourselves or to broaden the way we view men or the landscape.
And many nonprofits are coming to rely on big donations from a few wealthy donors. Chuck Collins from the Institute for Policy Studies says that growing inequity in charitable giving comes with risks.
The giving impulse is a healthy impulse, and I kind of want to both applaud that impulse and wave the red flag that these are problematic trends.
Thanks for tuning in to Aspen Public Radio's new show, Airtime. Stay tuned. Christine Potter is a Nashville-based photographer. She uses her stark images to look at the mythology of the American West. She spoke with Zoe Rome about her latest project, Manifest, a collection of landscapes and portraits that focuses on Colorado's western slope. It calls into question the stories and stereotypes that often surround the American West.
The title of your book, Manifest, where did that come from?
You know, when searching for titles, I kind of zeroed in on notions of manifest destiny. Taking destiny out of the title, for me, was a way to make a contemporary read on the space. In other words, it wasn't about the future or what could be, but rather what I found there.
Can you tell me a little bit about where these photographs were taken?
You know, when you look at the book, I don't locate it with much specificity. I don't try to talk about place in a very specific way. I wanted the work to feel almost generically Western, or that it could be in many places in the West. But obviously, I had to make them somewhere. And I found myself almost accidentally on the Western slope in a little town called Paonia. And I really just fell in love with the area. I just kept coming back to the area around Paonia. That area, and maybe probably a 90-mile radius around Paonia, Grand Junction, towns like that, are where I sort of centered myself for this work. And yeah, I just kept returning over the course of 3.5-4 years. I would come out for a week to stay and explore and meet people and make photographs.
So you have a family connection to the West. Your great-great-grandparents actually performed with Buffalo Bill. How has that shaped your relationship to the landscape and the mythology that surrounds it?
It's interesting. My family inherited all this ephemera from my great-great-grandparents, who indeed were married and were both sharpshooters. They performed with Buffalo Bill shows, but then they also created their own shows. There were many in that genre that toured the country and even Europe. And so when my family inherited this ephemera, I was helping them sort of archive it, and I was reading. There's these fantastic newspaper clippings from the late 1890s that, you know, were advertisements for the show. But the language was really that kind of generative language of the mythology we really know now of the American West. And I sort of came to realize that these were the first sort of purveyors of that myth before we had film and Westerns, which we all know. There was literature and there were these performative acts of Westernness. So I got really interested in the language in those newspaper clippings and then the photographs and the ephemera we inherited. And I just thought, oh, it's interesting that my family was sort of part of this generative story, generative impulse to tell this story that we now know, not just nationally, but globally, as a kind of iconography of America is really the American West.
What ideas about the West do you feel particularly drawn to or in conflict with?
Well, I'm enamored with it, as we all are. I study the history of photography, and there's an interesting correlation between the advent of photography and the settling of the Western landscape. And a lot of those primary survey photographs are very well known now. And I was studying them, and they're most of them are these vista views of the West. They show us mountains in the distance and this incredible expanse of land in front. I really came to see those as vista view repositories for our our dreams and aspirations for the country. And I think in a lot of ways, that's what the West has always represented. And then, of course, there are the characters who populate the West in Western cinema, in literature, all the way back to these Wild West shows, which were the kind of heroic cowboy characters who came to work the land and find their promise. So I was interested in both of those ideas, and my work previous to this was an exploration of a different archetype of American masculinity, which I was calling kind of the warrior. I was looking at soldiers or cadets at West Point more specifically, and I thought I'd pivot to another archetype of our American myth, which is the cowboy or the pioneer. And as is my general inclination, I'm always looking for ways to complicate the story we've told ourselves or to broaden the way we view either men or, in the case of this work, the landscape. So maybe it's not as welcoming as those Vista View photographs first told us. Maybe it's more complicated. Maybe it's a little bit more dangerous. Maybe it's a little bit more threatening. And as far as the cowboys are concerned, or the pioneers, maybe their experience of place is also a little bit more complicated than the kind of neatly told stories we have, through John Wayne or whatever vehicle has told us the story.
Western landscapes are often talked about in these gendered terms or in language that'll emphasize kind of this masculine control. How do you confront that in Manifest?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point and something I was thinking a lot about when I was out there. My experience coming out there was, of course it was one of wonder. It's an incredible landscape. But I also found it sometimes inhospitable, a little disorienting, the altitude, the heat, the sun. Photographically, I was 8,000 feet closer to the sun than I was back home. So there were a lot of things for me that I found worth exploring outside of what I call the vista view of the landscape. So the way I handled it was I tried to interpret that feeling. I make the landscapes. Most of them don't have a horizon. You can't see in a very long distance. You're really confronted with the kind of ruggedness, the brightness, the disoriented feeling. I wanted the landscapes to show something of how I felt. Some people have asked me whether the landscapes really represent a sort of feminine energy in the work. And I like that interpretation. I do like the interpretation that maybe this notion of Mother Earth is, of course, not as easily domineered as those original kind of vista views would purport.
Going back to what you said about kind of the mythology of the cowboy, there's lots of images of men in this book, and they're often wearing traditional Western clothing, but their position will have them in kind of different positions, like laying supine or even kind of curled up or hunched over, but they look really vulnerable. And I was wondering, what about traditional masculinity are you trying to convey or even reframe here?
I think I've always been interested in broadening the spectrum of permissible masculinity. And what I mean by that is I think that men are afforded a very narrow spectrum of what's okay. And anything that doesn't assert power, especially in a photograph, can make some people really uncomfortable. So I've always been interested in sort of the power dynamics of photographing someone else and, the power dynamics between a woman looking at a man. I hope that I do it in a way that is tender. In other words, I think that vulnerability is a really interesting thing to look at. And I think that everyone experiences it at some point or another, and there's no reason why that can't be part of our larger language. I certainly don't try to make all of these men look disempowered. That's certainly not the point. But I do mean to rock that power balance a little bit and to see what it looks like for a woman to look at a man in a more tendered way.
Right. And at one point you have this sequence, there's this, toward the back of the book, there's this kind of thick tree trunk, and then you see this nude male torso kind of, you're linking these two subjects or objects, and I'm wondering what's your thought there?
When you're making a book or editing pictures for a wall, you know, I start with a lot of pictures on a table, and I'm moving them around, and what can be really fascinating is what begins to happen in between pictures. You know, that's really sort of treasure of the book, is that you can create this sequence that begins to be information that happens in between pictures, not just in them. And, you know, one of the things that happens when you move pictures around, of course, is you start to see areas where this kind of kismet begins to happen in between forms often. And so here we have this hardened tree trunk in a dark landscape, and then you have this male torso kind of coming out of a darkness, and they feel similarly firm and strong and unrockable, and it's as simple as that. I just think turning the page and feeling as though you're looking at a similar form, but, you know, one is of the landscape and one is human, is worth flipping the page back and forth a few times to consider.
Right. So coming from kind of a more portrait-oriented background, dealing with human subjects, has that at all colored how you approached specifically these Western landscapes, which are so often, you know, personified?
Totally. I think unquestionably. Well, I'm closer to it than most landscape pictures. And for me, even the translation of that picture into a print is very much about an emotion. It's about feeling for me, which I think the portraits are about. So I make portraits of the landscape. I guess that's a good way to put it.
Having, you know, been steeped in a lot of the literature and art of this area, which is often so male dominated and focused on that perspective and that kind of vision, to me it was just really interesting and engrossing to see it from a different angle and kind of different subjects in that way.
What we do know of the West has been so saturated with a masculine interpretation. And I think this is part of the language that you're talking about, where the landscape has been described in these like kind of feminine terms as something that can be domineered or exploited in some way, but also how they see themselves in this story as these kind of heroic saviors of the land. And of course, we know mythology is mythology, right? We know that the movie doesn't tell the whole story, but there aren't a ton of examples of women reinterpreting the story.
That was photographer Christine Potter speaking with Zoe Rome. Her book of photography of Colorado's Western Slope, Manifest, is out now. You are listening to Airtime on Aspen Public Radio, the conversations, questions, and issues that deserve a little more time. You can catch these conversations again online, aspenpublicradio.org. Charitable contributions from wealthy donors have increased significantly over the past decade. Chuck Collins directs the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies. He says that growing inequity in charitable giving has downsides not only for nonprofits themselves, but also for the nation. Reporter Kristen Kay spoke with Collins about how nonprofits are coming to rely on big donors.
First, let's talk about the state of philanthropy now in the U.S. I'm wondering how you would characterize it.
I would say it's becoming increasingly top-heavy, meaning that for about 20 years, donations by low- and middle-income givers have been steadily going down, and almost all the growth in philanthropic giving is by wealthy donors and making kind of mega gifts.
Like, what is the level that we're talking about when we say mega gifts?
We're talking about people giving, $50 million gifts and up. or creating private foundations and donor-advised funds and other mechanisms that are, you know, sort of huge repositories of philanthropic giving.
And how did we get here? What has happened in the recent past that has kind of created this change?
These trends mirror the growth of inequality, income, wealth, and inequality in the United States. So as more wealth flows upwards and becomes more concentrated in, you know, the 1% or the top 0.1%, some of that money is flowing into the philanthropic sector, which is good. But so these trends mirror the fact that wealth is concentrating at the top, and also there's sort of a rising economic insecurity. So the trend in giving by low and middle income people tracks a lot of things like the declining home ownership rate and other things that just reflect that a lot of people don't feel economic security.
And you say there's a real downside here.
There are a number of perils to this top-heavy giving problem. One is the impact it might have on the independent sector, the nonprofit sector. When I first did fundraising 30 years ago, people used to say, there's the 80-20 rule. You get 80% of your donations from 20% of your donors. You obviously want to pay attention to your major donors, but you don't want to forget about everyone else. Well, now what happens is the dynamic shifts and you're getting 98% of your donations from 2% of your donors. That means you're spending a lot more time thinking about the concerns, interests, and priorities of a very small segment of donors. So it puts at risk the mission of the nonprofit sector. These bigger donors tend to be interested in larger nonprofits that have, you know, very sophisticated institutional giving offices. And so the bigger organizations are pulling down the bigger donations. And more money is also going into what I would just call warehousing. So wealthy people are giving money away, but they're giving it to a private foundation that they control or a donor advised fund. And that means that the money isn't actually immediately moving to active charities. It's potentially warehoused for decades in these philanthropic organizations. So there's also the larger risk to a democratic society, which is you have people reducing their taxes, avoiding taxes, giving to charity, reducing their tax bill, but maintaining a fair amount of private power over where the money goes. So the most important concern is that just recognizing philanthropy is not a substitute for a fair tax system and an adequately funded public sector at the local level, state, and federal level. We're just not going to be able to solve some of the big problems that we're dealing with through charity alone.
And when you say big problems that right now philanthropy seems to be kind of on the hook for addressing in our society, do you have some examples? Like what are you seeing in our society that you're like, this really needs to be addressed by government and by infrastructure?
Well, I would say, philanthropy is not going to build or repair the public infrastructure that we need. It's not going to help us retrofit and make a transition to a post-fossil fuel economy. It's not going to deal with the large environmental issues. It's not fundamentally going to change the dynamics of poverty and extreme inequality that we're living in. Philanthropy does some things really well. It helps create a laboratory for experimentation. But at some point, those good ideas need to be brought to scale. And that's where we need the sort of shared resources that only a tax-funded program can tackle. And one of the things I'm worried about is just how the discussion about philanthropy is sort of a distraction. It takes our attention away from what's really required to solve problems, like, let's just say, the problem of college affordability. Michael Bloomberg just made a wonderfully generous contribution to his alma mater at Johns Hopkins, $1.8 billion. It's going to make a huge difference in the lives of future generations of students who are going to be able to attend regardless of their income. And yet, that is not the answer to the larger challenges of affordability. We have reduced taxes on the wealthy, and we've stopped making some of the public investments that, after World War II, propelled a whole generation of people forward, including Michael Bloomberg, who, to his credit, would say, look, you know, I got a government-funded scholarship to be able to go to college. We need to restore, we need to bring that commitment back. So I just worry that the focus on philanthropy as the answer kind of deflects us from really taking on the harder challenge of what it is we're going to have to do to reduce inequality, fix the environment, build a healthy infrastructure.
I have a question about something that you've written. You said, when a billionaire gives a dollar, we chip in 40 to 50 cents in terms of lost tax revenue that could be used. Can you explain that?
Yeah, and this is probably one of the most misunderstood points, because people will say, look, you know, this is somebody's money. They're making a decision to where they want to give their money. That's their money. That's their decision. But I argue we have a public interest, and the public interest is when a billionaire gives a dollar, it actually ranges from like 37 to 57 cents of that contribution is, you know, we chip in for that in the form of lost tax revenue, meaning that person has reduced their income taxes, and for wealthy donors, they've also reduced their lifetime estate and what they might pay in an estate tax. And so that's a big subsidy. I mean, that's essentially saying you don't have to pay these taxes. We are essentially allowing you to make private decisions about what to do with your money. But remember, there is a public interest here. You know, it has to go to a qualified charity, and it has to serve a larger public interest. And that's why the rest of us have a stake and should have a say, to some extent, on what the priorities of charity, where the focus goes. It's not just simply a matter of private decision making. If people chose to give their money away and not take a tax deduction, that's a very different proposition, because they're basically going to continue to pay their income and estate taxes. But if they're asking the rest of us to subsidize it through the tax code, then there's a larger public interest.
So it sounds like thinking about some of those things in the tax code is one potential fix. What else do you see as potential fixes for top-heavy philanthropy?
We should create incentives to keep money flowing. So, for instance, donor advised funds should have a payout requirement. There should be some requirement to move that money in a timely way, I would say 3 to 5 years. We should ban the practice of private foundations and donor advised funds giving money back and forth between those entities and without any kind of accountability. I think we should increase the payout of private foundations. Right now, foundations have to give 5% of their asset base every year, but they can also include their overhead and sort of internal program fees. And a lot of resources gets chewed up in the administrative side of philanthropy. So I would argue exclude foundation operation costs from the payout, move 5% directly out the door to active charities. You know, not intermediaries, but active charities that are actually trying to solve problems. Those are some just reforms that would both encourage the money to move sooner. We also might want to look at just, you know, at a certain point, you know, if you have $1 billion and you give it all to charity, essentially creating a privately controlled pile of money, you know, maybe there should be a lifetime cap on just how much money can be given to charity where you're taking a deduction and reducing taxes. So even Bill Gates said to me one time, isn't it bizarre that I, you know, have $100 billion that I've created and I won't ever have to pay any taxes on that if I just give it to a charitable foundation, my own foundation? He says, there's something wrong with that. And I think he's right. There's, you know, so much of the foundation of wealth creation is the public investments that we make that create the fertile ground for technological advancement and human advancement. And you know, if you have that level of wealth, some of that should go back to maintaining that fertile ground, not just through private philanthropy.
Chuck, what else would you like to clarify about top-heavy philanthropy and sort of its dangers?
I would just say that I think that the giving impulse is a healthy impulse, you know, and people see problems and they want to solve them, and we're kind of, the discussion moves immediately into sort of what can philanthropy do. And, you know, I kind of want to both applaud that impulse and just sort of wave the red flag that these are problematic trends. You know, if these trends continue, we're going to see kind of an impoverished public sector. We're going to see more and more austerity. There's not enough money. There's no money for schools. There's no money for, you know, these social needs. And at the same time, we're going to see the rise of these, you know, extraordinary private pillars of power, really. They're private decision-making institutions. They're not publicly accountable. And, you know, some of them do great work and cutting-edge thinking. But there's a lot of philanthropy that just kind of maintains the unequal status quo, or worse, kind of compounds it. And so I just come back to reminding us that philanthropy is an important part of our society, and it sustains this marvelous independent sector that's outside of government, and that's a wonderful and unique thing about the United States in many ways. And it's just not a substitute for raising money from a public tax system and a democratically accountable government that makes decisions. As weak and sometimes unaccountable as it may seem, it's still the best thing we have in terms of democratic decision-making.
Chuck Collins, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Oh, thank you.
That was Chuck Collins from the Institute on Policy Studies speaking with Kristen Kay about the implications of top-heavy philanthropy. You've been listening to Airtime on Aspen Public Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in. This week, you heard from reporters Zoe Rome and Kristen Kay. You can podcast or stream this show online, aspenpublicradio.org. Airtime is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.